Welcome to Beta Readings.
Lit from the basement.
This is Danielle.
And this is Max.
I'm an author and professor.
I'm a heretofore no more hooligan, now stay-at-home dad.
We're a married couple who discusses literature in our basement while our children are sleeping.
The boys are now asleep.
So let's talk. And tonight...
it's date night.
Double dates with Olivia and David, our dear friends who have agreed to come and spend their evening with us in our basement.
In the basement.
Which is fantastic. We're so excited that we're here. And Olivia has chosen a poem for us to discuss. But first, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do in your day-to-day life?
I live in Portland, so David and I drove down for tonight, and I'm a labor doula, which means that, I know that's not a very common word, it means that I am a non-medical birth professional who helps families who are having children. So I do prenatal consultations with my clients, and then I stay with them through their entire delivery, however long that may be, and then I do postpartum support as well.
And this work is... wonderful, miraculous. I had a doula in my birth with my first son. We were very far away from home, living in Cincinnati. Well, that was our home at the time. What I mean is I was very far away from any family.
From our people. She was a wonderful support for us.
Yeah, our doula, Lauren, at the time. And so I'm a real believer in the necessity of having somebody who's trained and more objective and therefore emotional support for all of the people involved.
The objective thing is, I think, a huge part of it. Something that I say to people when I'm in interviews all the time is that birth is a time warp and no idea where you are or what time it is or how long you've been doing this thing. And it can be really nice to have someone who not only knows what hour of the day it is or what that, but also what that means you've been progressing and just keeping an eye on how things go. When I'm at a delivery, I usually make notes of what time things happen and who's in the room so that if my clients want to know afterwards, like, who was that nurse who was really nice and helped me get into the bathtub?
Yeah.
I can be like, her name was Stacy. If you want to write her a thank you
note.
She
came in 4 hours ago.
Right, exactly.
That's actually really interesting that you say that because in my experience of the limited experience I had of actually laboring, which I labored with Mercer for 12 hours. It ended up with a C-section later on. But during those 12 hours, I mean, it went by so fast. I could not even believe it, which I would never have expected before that particular moment, right? Like, there was no way that anybody could convince me that being in pain for like off and on for 12 hours was going to be
go
like
quickly.
Yeah, exactly. But it had this crazy effect of, you know, being in a lot of pain and having those waves of pain and then it going away and me being like, oh, I'm fine. Can I have a sandwich? Like, hey, what's going on? Hey, everybody. Like, I mean, it got toward 12 hours, like super intense, but I couldn't believe that it happened so quickly. So
I've had a couple clients who for first children had in like medically considered rapid births. I'm talking about less than 5 hours from first contraction to baby with first births.
Yeah.
And when I explain that to people, everybody's always like, oh, it sounds like the dream. And I'm like, no, 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 no. That gives you no time to process the fact that I'm going from a pregnant person to a mom. And that's a really big thing to process.
Well, also, I would just think that like the pain factor, like would go from nothing to redlining it.
Accurate.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I haven't done it.
Yeah.
But that's what it looks like.
Well, you know, my birth ended up being, you know, miserable and you know, not at all anywhere near the actual crowning or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's such a wonderful thing that you are doing for these families, and
they're
very lucky to have you.
David often jokes that I talk about it so much that he's going to be my doula at when we eventually have children.
Speaking of David.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
David is here with us as well.
Yeah, I have learned enough. I gleaned enough from when you're in the classes and from all the births you've been in. I can handle it.
Yeah, and the thing that I always say back is you don't realize that you are also going to be in the time warp with me.
That's very true.
Well, we are very excited that David and Olivia are going to be getting married next month.
Woo-woo.
Max is best man in David's wedding.
Indeed.
And
Olivia's wedding, too.
Nope. Yeah, but I didn't
just
check
mine.
We're really excited for them to get this union underway. Officially, anyways. They've been unionized for a while.
It's true.
Here's a quick word on behalf of our sponsor. Spitzer Technology Consulting is the all-in-one tech company for anything from hardware installation to software migration, even building a personalized website. Spitzer Tech strives to exceed your expectations while being conscious of your budget. They take pride in using best-in-class hardware and software to ensure you function at your best with stable, worry-free technology. Looking for IT with a personal touch? Go to spitzertech.net. That's SPITZERTECH.net. Or just scroll to the bottom of our own website for the link and see what they can do for you. Spitzer Technology Consulting. When you call, they answer. When you email, they reply.
And we're back.
And since I'm not the one who chose this poem, could you tell us a little bit about why you chose this Rilke poem?
Okay. I chose Be Ahead of All Parting by Rainier Marie Wilke, and it's from his book, Sonnets to Orpheus. And I chose this poem because we're reading it tonight in translation by Stephen Mitchell, which I guess is an important thing to say because I did not read it in German. I really love this translation, and I love this poem. I chose it because when I was in college, I had one, I'm sure everyone has this, that one semester that was particularly rough for you.
Oh, yeah.
When
definitely
you're in college.
For me. Yeah, no, I can,
between
I can
the
think
ages,
very vividly of the semester
that, one
that things
semester,
went
right.
really south for me. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So during my south semester, let's call it that, I was taking a class on German poets, and this poem came up, and there were just a lot of pieces about it that really resonated with me.
Yeah.
I've always been a visual person, and so I took pieces of this poem and put them all over my room. So I had the end of the first stanza on my window shade, so when I pulled down my windows at night, and it was dark, I could see it, and I had, you know, pieces of the, I think it's this third stanza were above my mirror, and I just lived with this poem in my space physically for an entire semester. So that's why I picked it. It's the first thing that comes to mind when I think of poetry that really is in my body.
Do you think that it being in your space gave you some kind of sustenance or rejuvenation or...
There's this, I don't want to like give away too much because I know we're about to read it, but there's a line in it that there is a one winter that is so endlessly winter that only by wintering through it will your heart survive.
Yeah.
And that was my south semester. I really just like believed I had to winter through it. And felt that.
What was going on that made you need this poem?
Yeah. So I'm just going to answer honestly and then we'll reflect on whether or not this is appropriate.
Yeah. Okay.
So I am a white woman of a certain age, and I was raised with by very well-intending feminist parents who told me that if you work hard enough, you can have whatever you want.
Right.
And I am a hard worker. By nature, that's what makes me feel good, makes me feel whole and productive when I'm doing good, hard work. So I felt like I worked really hard and I got into the school I wanted and I was working really hard at being good at that school.
Mm-hmm.
And then the economy crashed, which when you're 19, what does that even mean? Uh-huh. And my parents were like, you do work really hard and you can't go here anymore. And we are taking you out of your Vermont cocoon and bringing you home, which... I went to a private high school, and so the idea of not being in college was very shameful. So I was going to be out of school, like I dropped out, but I didn't. We just ran out of money.
Right.
From this place that I felt was very beloved to me.
Yeah.
Like I knew from the moment I stepped on, I went to a very idyllic school. Those of you listening who are Bennington grads, you know what I'm talking about.
I almost went to Bennington, actually.
Right. Yeah. Bennington is just, it's just so beautiful. And I remember when I first stepped on campus as a student, I was terrified. I was 2,500 miles away from home. I was 18. I had never done this before. And simultaneously, I absolutely knew I was never going to take a semester abroad because I couldn't spend a moment away from this place that I was as long as I was allowed to be there.
Yeah.
So having... people tell me that I had to leave was really hard.
Yeah.
And it was hard to go through the motions of being there, knowing that everything was kind of the last. It was like this, not to be dramatic, but it was like this prolonged death march, right?
Oh, yeah.
To the end. And it started in the winter in Vermont. So let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So you were encased in ice.
Yeah. So it was literally wintering through to make my heart survive. And the end of the story is that I had some really amazing professors. And if somehow this podcast ever makes it to Annabelle Davis Goff, she should know that nearly 10 years out, she still holds a very fond place in my heart. I had some really amazing professors who essentially stormed the financial aid office and got me the money I needed to stay.
That's amazing. Love that.
Yeah, which I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. So I did end up graduating from Bennington, and I did end up getting to stay. And it was dramatic in the most intense way. It happened like 2 days before I left campus. I'd already shipped all the stuff home, and I was saying goodbye to everyone and giving away my furniture. And yeah, I decided I was running away to New York to go live with my friend Carly in her apartment in Brooklyn. There were big plans. And then I got my funding.
Should we
get to the reading?
Shall we read the poem?
Okay.
Would you like to read it?
Sure. Be Ahead of All Parting by Rainier Marie Rilke. Be ahead of all parting, as though it were already behind you, like the winter that has just gone by. For among these winters, there is one so endlessly winter that only by wintering through it all will your heart survive. Be forever dead in Eurydice, more gladly arise into the seamless life proclaimed in your song. Here, in the realm of decline, among momentary days, be the crystal cup that shattered even as it rang. Be, and yet know, the great void where all things begin, the infinite source of your own most intense vibration, so that, this once, you may give it your perfect assent. To all that is used up, and to all the muffled and dumb creatures in the world's full reserve, the unsayable sums, joyfully add yourself and cancel the count. I started smiling as I read it. There's so much about this poem that I love. So just to go back to what I was saying about living with the words, I had the endlessly winter, and I also had be the crystal cup that shattered even as it rang, which if that's not a 19-year-old girl feeling some big feelings, I don't know what is.
Interestingly, Rilke wrote this at the very end of his life, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Sonnets to Orpheus was his last composition. He wrote it in the middle of writing, the middle of finishing the Duino elegies, which he started writing 10 years before. And then
when he was living in the Duino castle, right?
Yeah. When he was living in the Duino castle, but then here he was also living in a castle like space.
Oh, Rilke.
A chateau, chateau de, Musot. I'm going to have to look up that pronunciation.
I just know it was a castle.
It was a castle in Switzerland. It was a 12th century structure.
Like you do.
he had a patron. Well, partly the reason why he was there was because of the war. It was actually very hard to find any kind of housing, and his patron found him.
So he had to settle for a castle?
No. It wasn't actually a luxurious...
It was hard all the way around.
No, it wasn't a luxurious space because it actually didn't have a lot of the modern amenities. So people generally weren't drawn to rent this. His patron rented it for him so that he could finish the Duino elegies. And in the middle of writing that, he wrote the Sonnets to Orpheus, that book, in a matter of weeks, in the middle of it. And he says that it seems to have come from nowhere. Like he was dictating what mm-hmm. was being told to him. But I kind of see it as a poet who'd been working on his language his entire life, This is a man at the very end of end of his life. He died just a couple of years after this, who was at the full height of his capability, right? And so it's not unsurprising to me that somebody who had been practicing that long and thinking about poetry that long would find himself alone in a castle in February and just be like, I'm just going to write. I'm just going to keep writing this book.
Right.
And did.
It's interesting that you brought up the point about language, because when in the context of the class that I came across this poem in, we were talking about German poets surrounding both world wars and the topic of the violence inherent in their language and what it felt like to be working through a medium that you knew was also connected to so many atrocities and such hardship at the time, and how hard that was with that knowledge.
There was all this insanity surrounding Germany and the German language. He was actually born in Prague, but he was in a German-speaking family. And so, therefore, that is the epitome of brownies. The men are eating cookies.
I'm just eating a brownie.
Nothing wrong with that.
We'll go back to your business.
I love that you brought up that this is a poem in translation by Stephen Mitchell here. What I have below the paper, if you want to take a look at it, is another translation, which I found by somebody named Robert Temple, whose work I'm unfamiliar with. But I mean, what I would like to do is for you to notice a little bit about how different the language is. I mean, especially this final line.
That's what I was just looking at.
Yeah. Joyfully add yourself and cancel the count is what Stephen Mitchell wrote. And then down here you have add yourself with jubilation to them and nullify the account, which has a much more business sounding, you know, as if it were a kind of ledger.
Yeah.
That is occurring. And I have to say, I mean, the Stephen Mitchell translation is much better. What were you going to say, David?
Oh, just specifically that first line, at least for me. So when it ends with as though it were already there.
Yep.
And as if it were already behind you. And that specifically, that line, you and I had an upset and change in our relationship a few years ago, is what sticks out to me, because that is kind of exactly what we had to do. Which is moving forward as if we're looking at the future and we're in that future rather than the nightly crying and long discussion sessions we were having, which is you want something to speak to you. And that specifically was the one that after we read the first time that I saw that, I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, well, I definitely do think that period of our lives, the idea of wintering through something in order to allow your heart to survive was definitely the point of it. Sometimes when I get massages, I get deep tissue massages, and the massage therapists are always like, so I'm going to be really hard on you and you just tell me when it's too much. And I'm like, I'm a doula. I believe the only way out is through. Like, let's go. And I don't know how much of that comes from Rilke, because I do very firmly believe that you just have to get through something. There's no avoiding it, that you can't avoid it in birth and you can't avoid it in hard emotional situations.
It got us to being able to get married, man.
I have a different take on that first line, and it's only reinforced by you talking about him trying to wrestle with atrocities attached to language. Is anybody here not familiar with the expression the Irish goodbye?
Oh, no, I know that one.
Basically, it's when you cut out of a party without saying goodbye. You don't want to deal with the hassles of it.
Peace him out.
So pretty much is how I interpreted the first thing. Be ahead of all parting as though you were already behind you. It's just somebody who skipped out of a party.
I'm gone.
Yeah, I'm gone. Don't need to do, I took my Tupperware full of stuff. I'm out.
Like the winter that has just gone by.
Well, then that complicates my interpretation, so I ignore it.
The percentage of doing that grows later in life. I think we Irish goodbye for pretty much every party at this point.
I usually have to hug everybody and kiss everybody before I leave, so goodbyes are very long for me. But I mean, one of the things I really love about this poem, I think it has like some terrific advice, right? I mean, what you were saying about how this poem worked in your life, and then David, what you were saying about how this is working in your lives together, to kind of steel yourself, to have a certain tenacity and a certain faith that tenacity is going to lead you into something better.
Yeah, totally. And I think the thing that spoke to me then and still does now is this, the building that he does throughout the poem. So he starts with stuff is going to be bad and you just got to keep walking, wintering through it.
Right.
And then there's this idea of you can walk through it with grace. You can be the crystal cup that even as it's breaking is still making a beautiful sound.
Yeah.
The crystal cup that shattered even as it rang. And then there's this kind of moment of like reflect, right? So this is hard. You're walking through it. You're doing it well. Reflect on what's going on. Like look into that void. Look into the hardness. And then this final stanza that I might just read again because it makes me so happy. This, to all that is used up and to all the muffled and dumb creatures in the world's full reserve, think about everyone who makes you crazy. Think about everything that's terrible. To the unsayable sums, joyfully add yourself, just you, and cancel the count.
Right.
The fact that you're enough to outweigh fill in the blank, the things that make you crazy. That
right.
guy that sits across from you at work, the terrible traffic, the situation in our nation, the
yeah,
anything.
I was going to say our president.
Right.
I am not enough to offset him, though.
But Rilke thinks you are. And that's the amazing thing. And that build to that ending of like, I know it's hard, but you are enough.
I think that this sort of joyful sense at the end of it. I mean, add yourself joyfully. He literally says joyfully, right? So I'm being redundant here. But, you know, in talking to a lot of my friends after the election who were very depressed and, you know, who still aren't great. But I think that ultimately the people who have sort of risen to do something positive. I mean, I feel like this is very much a poem that is calling you to action. Do something, not just do something, be great, right? Like,
right.
Be amazing.
Yeah.
Ring out.
Specifically about the depression of the election, that's, we actually went and did that. We became the...
cookie bearers.
The baked good elves. So we after that, we go home the next day, and we're driving home. And I was gruff about it, which is not the best. I told Olivia, I was like, look, you get tomorrow.
Oh, you're talking about the night of the election
I was sobbing while you were driving?
I
was like, you get tomorrow to be deep in it. But then that's it. Like the day after, you have to start like moving forward. Otherwise, we're never going to make it through.
Right.
And so our first course of action was that next day we went out and we bought like $100 worth of baked goods.
And
tiny individual milks. Unfortunately, the worst milks. It was the Mad Dog 2020 of individual milks.
Which we didn't know until we gave them out to all our friends.
What?
And
how?
On the way home, it was fortified
like
calcium.
Fortified, cheap, nasty milk. But I didn't realize it when I bought it. And then I got thirsty on the drive.
But how cute to have a carton of milk. Who's had that since they were like kindergarten?
Well, right. After they tasted it, I'm probably no one else again. And we drove around from house to house from all of our friends we know who had been experiencing it the worst. And we're just like, knock, knock. Here's a box of cookies and some milk and a hug. Peace.
I love that.
It was like Santa's sleigh in November. I really appreciated that night, other than the good story that it is now, but because I came home from work and I none of the feelings I'd felt had lifted. It had only been a day and I was really in the bottom of it. And I appreciated that David knew that, you know, going back to that hard worker thing, the way I feel best is when I feel like I'm being productive and in service to other people.
Yeah.
And he was able to bring that out in me and really make me feel like I could do something, even though it wasn't, you know, it wasn't calling senators and it wasn't marching in the streets, but it was something for our friends.
Giving
who are
solace.
Home.
Yeah. Giving solace to your friends, I think is, that's one of the best things you can do. You're taking care of the people that you love, right? They're the ones who needed the milk and cookies. So good thing they got it.
Me, I took to social media and changed thousands of people's minds.
Yeah, that was the very short period of time I think you were silenced on Facebook for me.
Yeah, I think my exact thing was, I'm going to be gone for a couple of days.
So should we talk a little bit about the sort of elegant structure of this? It is in a sonnet form, and I'm actually quite impressed that the translator... Now, I don't know any German, so I can't do any kind of comparison. Max, do you know?
Ein bisschen.
I was going to say, do we have the German here?
I don't think that we have the German here.
We're here in the basement. Rainy and Ray Rilke.
Happily read the German for you.
Rilke, take it away. one of the things I'm very impressed with in the translation of this is that the translator managed to not only translate it into a really kind of elegant form. You'll look at the other translation, how the lines are really overly long sometimes. Mm-hmm. And that, so visually, the poem looks tight. It looks like it was originally written in English. But then also, there's still a great musicality to a lot of what of the language that they've used here. I mean, you have dum and sums. I mean, so this is in a it's in a Petrarchan sonnet form, which means that the first two stanzas are quatrains, and the next two stanzas are tercets, and there's a certain rhyme scheme. But what I'm sort of impressed with is that the person kept the rhyme scheme. It's slant rhyme. But that they managed to keep a rhyme scheme at all. In a lot of other languages I've seen where, you know,
they drop it in yeah. the effort of translation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and sometimes doesn't the translation just not lend itself to that?
Yeah, for sure. Most of the time it doesn't.
Yeah.
But I think a really excellent translator pays attention not only to the sort of connotative meaning of various words and finds the right sort of lexicon to draw from the English language in order to do service to the poem, but also pays attention to the musicality that the poet may have been working in. So without having read the original, the Rilke, in its original German language, I would have to think that Rilke was paying attention to the musicality of the form. And that is why the translator decided to lean on the musicality of it. You have
the professor who I took this class with, Mark Wunderlich. He speaks German, and so he would whatever poem we were studying, we would read it, and someone in the class would read it in English, and he would read it in German, and someone else would read it again, so we could hear it.
Oh,
the
nice.
Musicality.
So he
of it.
Selected this particular translation then.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes. He was very this class was his baby. He was very picky about who we read and what we talked about. And the little bit of work that I've done with translating poetry, my understanding of it, and again, really just a brush with it in the night. But the thing that I learned is that when you're looking at words in another language and trying to bring them from one language to another, you really have to look at every word with a soft focus, and you have to see all the words that kind of live around it, if that makes any sense.
Right.
Because you can't just like, I think that the last line in this Robert Temple translation is a great one. This add yourself with jubilation to them. And Stephen Mitchell translates it as joyfully add yourself. And mm-hmm. so what that meant was one of them is more close to the grammatical structure of Rilke's original line.
Right.
But one of them is much easier to say in our language.
Right. It'd be nice if we had the original one and we could see if the word was Jauche, then we'd know which way was closer.
There you go. Thank you, Max.
Can anybody at least acknowledge that I have a smug look on my face?
Oh, a very smug look on his face. He's sort of rubbing his chest and sniffing.
But the idea is if you're translating and the word you come up with in direct translation is jubilation, knowing that joyfully kind of lives in that in mm-hmm. that gray area near the word jubilation is
right.
really the trick of a translator.
Yeah. Well, there's also in translation the sort of idea that, I mean, depending on which sort of philosophy of translation you're drawing from, the idea that the point is not necessarily to directly build the poem, but to create a poem in the translated language.
Yes.
That those people in that language would respond to in the same sense. So this really talk about gray area and this weird sort of constellation of meaning, but also in a kind of sense of emotional truth that the poem is relating.
Yeah. The first poem I ever translated, I was translating from Spanish to English, and I translated it directly word for word in my first pass. And I knew that wasn't how it was going to be.
Right.
But I was like, I just feel like I need to get a really good, solid understanding of what is happening in this poem. Uh-huh. And I translated it, and I was like, this was never a poem in the first place. This is a jumble of words.
Yeah.
And I had to go back to the Spanish to like get myself back in the game because I'd just done all this long work of translating this whole poem. And then I was like, this was rubbish. This is a monkey at a computer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's hard.
So it sounds like you probably know a fair bit about Rilke having taken this class, or this is probably a class from like 10 years ago. So we're not going to.
Danielle's responding to the panic on my face. I feel like he's a friend.
He is a friend. He's a friend to you. I feel that way about certain poets and certain poems, you know, that got me through something. Rilke, for those of you who don't know him, was born in 1875 and died in 1926. And he's one of the most famous German language poets. His work is really known for its lyrical intensity, but it's also really known well for his philosophy and the way that he incorporated his philosophy into his work. He very much rejected his parents' Catholicism and Christianity in general, which of course was not popular in this era, just generally speaking. And he really was trying to find solace and a kind of sense of morality in art itself. That's more or less what he came to. So his exploration of morality and the way in which one could bring meaning to their life was just constantly looking toward art as opposed to religion. And I think a lot of people who came after him in the sort of contemporary era really felt that to be true for them, right? Rilke, during his lifetime, was really celebrated by the other poets and writers of the time. He had kind of a crazy life. He actually met Trotsky. He was a personal friend and secretary for a little while of Rodin. But his work itself wasn't really known very well to the general public. It really wasn't until after he died that his work became as celebrated as it currently is.
When you say that other people knew him like that, was to be considered, like, the term was always thrown around like of a comedian's comedian.
Yeah, he's a poet's poet for
right,
sure.
Right, where all the other, you bring up a name and all the comedians are like, oh my God, he's a genius.
Yeah, he's a genius. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, that was him during his
lifetime.
That
was actually one of my concerns when I texted Danielle at one point after she asked me, and I was like, I'm overthinking this. I'm choosing too many poems. And she was like, well, what was your like knee jerk first one? And I sent her this one and I said, but I feel like it's so clearly a college kid's poem. Like it's so dense. And that's what
I meant.
You
had
this up
and then maybe also like a poster of Klimt and or Van Gogh. Yeah, Klimt's The Kiss and or Van Gogh's Starry Night. Like
that's
those
okay.
are the
I have wanted our first poem to be Solomon Grundy. And Danielle said no, so it's okay.
I better inevitably make it on here.
Maybe he'll have to. Yeah, he was a total poet's poet. He actually published his first book when he was 19. Oh, here's a fun fact about Rilke. It's not a fun fact at all. It's really tragic. Okay.
I was going to say, I don't know how many.
Yeah, fun fact.
He was addicted to mercury.
They smoked it like crazy back then. No, he was the only child of his parents. They sent him away to military school when he was like 11 years old.
German military school in the 1800s.
Yeah. What could go wrong?
Yeah. How strict could they be?
Well, he was there not very long before he became very ill. He had a lot of health issues throughout his entire life, and this is sort of the first manifestation
of castles. It.
Yeah, totally. Like that cannot be good for one's respiratory system at the very
least.
He died
in his 40s, apparently.
I think he died at like 51. Is that right?
Born in 75 and died in 20 something.
Born in 75 and died in 1926.
Okay, sorry. My math is shitty. Yeah, okay, that is 51.
You were close, though. 51, 40s.
I mean, that wasn't premature necessarily for that particular era that we're talking about. But yeah, so he was sent away to boarding school when he was 11. He got sick and came home to find his parents divorced and, like, his dad gone.
Moved out.
Yeah, talk about trauma, right? Like you're 11 years old, you go, first of all, you're sent to military school at 11. But clearly there was something going on in the relationship before, and they were like, let's get rid of the kid, and then while the kid's gone, we're just gonna divorce.
Oh.
Yeah, awful. He had, I can't remember if it was a family friend or an uncle who realized that he was very, very bright, and so paid for him to go to a preparatory school. Where, you know, he flourished much better than he did at a military academy. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure. You know, he entered university fairly young. But yeah, by the time he was 19, he'd published his first book. So yeah, poet's poet for sure. Everybody was like, this guy's a genius. But I mean, a lot of people who start really young, especially in this particular era, you know, you have some of these famous poets who start with a blast and die very young. I'm thinking of Keats. I'm thinking of Rimbaud. Yeah, I mean that it's sort of popular to be like, they were a genius at 19 and then they died. You know,
when they were 27.
Yeah, exactly.
Always. My mom said that the grad students in the lit program at her school wore black armbands on their 26th birthday because Keats died at 26. And what have you done?
Jesus.
Well, Keats was also a genius, so there's that.
Yes.
I'm not a genius, so I hadn't published my book by 26. So yeah, that's the fun fact of Rilke, is that he's 11 when his parents divorced
secretly.
Secretly while he was away. Can you imagine? It's totally horrible.
I was worried you were going to say that he came back from school and they weren't there. Like, they both were ghosted.
Well, I was expecting you to say he came back with syphilis, which is dangerous back then.
It's always dangerous.
I mean, I think that inside that story may be the root of the reason he rejected his parents' supposedly Catholic beliefs. Right. I mean, I can't say, he's not here to ask. But I think that probably if you're 11 and you're sent away to military school and you come back and your parents are no longer your parents in the way that they were before, and they're like, you should still believe in God. I think that he's like, well, weren't you supposed to believe in God? And wasn't that supposed to be a sacrament? And what are you doing divorcing? You know, that I don't. And because he's a highly intelligent person, clearly. And flourished in an academic setting, I'm sure he was like, you guys are hypocrites. Like, what is this that you believe in?
Only so much shenaniganry you'll put up with before you call foul play.
Yeah. So he, you know, he, I think was, I mean, he's very, I mean, this poem is very like romantic in its purview, right? I mean, be forever dead in Eurydice. More gladly arise into the seamless life proclaimed in your song. I mean, there is a kind of relentless joyfulness in this. And like I said before, it was written quickly in the month of February, basically. This one poem as part of the entire book of Sonnets to Orpheus. He did meditate on later it being feeling like it was sort of dictated to him as opposed to him writing it. But in further investigation and him sort of thinking toward it, he sort of pinpoints the initial sort of catalyst for this being alone in a castle in Switzerland in February. But then he got a letter from good friends of his that their daughter had died. And he couldn't get away from thinking about that for them. The sort of grief of having somebody very young and obviously somebody that they loved very much gone, and the sort of tremendous loss of the possibility of this young girl. And so he sort of began writing the poems kind of in response to the situation. And then as the poems go on in the book, more almost to that girl and to that situation. He doesn't talk a lot about it directly, but there is a certain energy to this that I think you may have picked up on as a young woman, right, who is in winter and feeling like all of this despair. Like,
right.
It's possible Rilke is your friend, and it's possible that he did write this for you. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know from what I do remember from my class, embarrassment, sorry, Mark Wunderlich, was his fascination with this Orpheus Eurydice story.
Oh, yeah.
Which just to like cover briefly, which I'm sure I think that both of the gentlemen in this room know, is that Orpheus was this renowned lute player. And he and his bride, Eurydice, were going to get married. And on the day of their wedding, she is walking barefoot in the grass like you do in Greek legends and gets bit by a snake.
As you do in Greek legends.
And dies. And Orpheus is destroyed. He had this beautiful bride and lost her right when, their union was at his fingertips. And he uses his lute to kind of plead his case to the pantheon of gods and say, like, please let me have her back. And And so
it
Hades...
helps that he was Apollo's son.
Oh yeah,
yeah. And, no, it, that helped, but yeah, I mean, yeah, the lute. He's
sort
of
the big part. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, Orpheus was a poet's poet. Like, yes. like he's like the patron saint of poetry, right? Like,
yes.
Like poets love Orpheus. I can think of like several other poems right now that like talk to or refer to Orpheus. Like Orpheus comes up constantly in allusions. But yeah, that he could use his music and his charm to charm anything.
Even gods. Yeah, sway them with this very, very human condition, right? I've lost this person. You don't even know what that feels like. You're immortal.
Right.
But like, let me play my music and convince you that it's real bad.
Right.
And so they're like,
real
okay.
John Cusack moment.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly. It's say anything.
Orpheus going into the underworld to talk
with
to Hades
boom
with
box.
The boombox over his head.
I just want to describe for people that there are three people in this tiny basement room with their hands
simultaneously.
Over their
they
head.
All raise their hands over the head to hold the gobbler boombox.
So he gets to the underworld and Eurydice is there and she's lovely and dead. And Hades is like, okay, you can have her, but catch is that you can't look at her until you're back in the world of the living.
Right.
And so, of course, it's a very long walk back to the world of the living.
And
because
he couldn't hear her footsteps.
Because she's dead.
Because she's dead. And so
right.
She's like floating behind him. And so he starts to
doubt the whole thing. Yes.
He starts to doubt everything, right? Like, did the gods trick me? Is she actually there? He began to doubt that the gods had actually given him the gift that they had.
Which is a normal doubt to have. They spent a lot of time messing around.
Touché.
No kidding. Yeah, that's
so,
a fine point.
Of course, the end of the story is that he's within sight of the land of the living. He can see the light from that. And his doubt overtakes him and he turns. And he sees her briefly.
And he turns to salt.
And different story. Close, though. Sees her briefly, and she vanishes forever, and he can't have her back.
Tragedy.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then, you know, he leaves from there, and he's tragic. You know, I mean, there's no way that no man can enter the underworld twice.
Right.
While alive, anyways. The other time that he would go there is when he's dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point...
Am I remembering that incorrectly? But he went and found his death at the hands of a frenzy.
Oh, yeah. The Maenads.
Yeah.
Ooh, the Maenads. I was obsessed with the Maenads. Well, I'm kind of obsessed with Greek mythology anyway. The death of Orpheus is that he's on a mountainside with his lute and desperate and sad. And the Maenads, who had worked themselves into a bacchic frenzy from wine and dancing and probably sex, I'm just going to, I like to think so, found him on the mountainside and tore him limb to limb while in this crazy frenzy. I guess it would be a Dionysian frenzy and not a bacchic frenzy.
Kind of
right,
free.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, wrong god.
I would like to say, I've often wanted to say that you're pretty much a muse in the streets and a maenad in the sheets.
There you go.
That is by far the best compliment I have ever received.
I'm going to take this opportunity to talk to Max and Daniel's faithful listeners and let you know that they are this adorable in real life, and they do flirt with each other constantly.
All the time.
Wait, and also, since you're here, can you also verify that we literally start the show?
That you're very good looking? Oh, no. No.
We have photos on our website.
Right here.
No, I meant as a couple.
No, but I mean that this show literally starts when our kids go to sleep.
Yes, much later than we'd like it to.
Oh, yes.
Much later than anybody would like it to. These two people are the loveliest for sitting right here right now. They brought us brownies and wine. So thank you so much. I really enjoy these.
We're just hoping to be internet famous.
It'll be so nice.
So, yeah. So this allusion to Orpheus and Eurydice, of course, like I said, it does make him a poet's poet. There are so many poems that I can think of in the contemporary moment who use this allusion. Two of my favorite, one is What the End is For by Jory Graham, that ends with the tearing of Orpheus limb from limb and his head being thrown into a river and how it keeps singing. Oh, that's part of the myth. So they tear him limb to limb and throw his head into the river, where his head keeps singing and singing and singing as it flows down the river, to indicate that like the world will always be filled with the song of Orpheus. So though he himself dies, his work lives on.
Yeah.
Right? Which is why he's sort of the patron saint of artists.
He's the crystal cup that shattered even as it rang.
He absolutely is. You're dun, right. Dun, dun. That was good. That was an awesome bring in.
Hasn't Lorca replaced it as the patron saint now?
No, because a lot of people don't buy into Lorca in the same way. Although, I was thinking of a Lorca.
Don't buy that, that he died?
Lorca, sadly, was shot by a dictator. That's what happened to Lorca.
It's not as dreamy.
Not as dreamy.
Ripped apart and singing as you float away.
Yeah.
And he was an actual person, so there's that. But I actually was thinking a lot about Lorca while I was reading through some of the biographical information about Rilke composing this poem, right? He said that, it seemed like a voice from nowhere, that it seemed also to be precipitated by this young girl's death. And when you talk about Lorca, when you talk about Duende, and the idea is that the poet is a kind of, and any artist or dancer or singer, but mostly things that are related to music, right? Which feels very ephemeral and physical both at once, because it completely transforms your physicality and your mental state. So in Lorca's idea of duende in connection to poetry and music, it's as if you are possessed by the spirit of the earth. And I was thinking about that very much when I was reading this biographical information about how Rilke composed this, that he sort of felt like it was Orpheus speaking to him, right? This kind of spirit that guided him into writing this. So there's something very ghostly about that. But ghostly, it's like a friendly ghost. It's a ghost that gives you like a famous book.
Hallucinating in a Swiss castle with the head of Orpheus dictating poetry to me.
This sounds like a Deadwood episode.
How wonderfully German.
I think that there was actually a painting of Orpheus in the castle. I could be wrong about that.
It sounds apocryphal, but I'm totally willing to believe it.
We'll take it. Actually, I believe the walls bled it out.
Yeah. And like an episode of Scooby-Doo, the eyes kept moving.
I've got to write back to this guy. That's what he eventually came up with.
I was going back to the poem. His use of the word vibration. Maybe as a Californian, kind of hooked me. when you want to speak of a spirituality, but you want to attach it to already an established religion, we speak of vibes or, whims of the great magnet, as Thompson would say. Is there, I guess, just throwing out, hovering on the word vibration, you said that he rejected his Catholicism. Is this a common thing where people come back to, I believe in a spirituality? Is it kind of a agnostic thing?
Before Danielle answers that, I'm going to point out that the Robert Temple translation also uses the word vibration. So
Rilke.
So that sounds like it's
a direct word.
Yeah. Whatever German is for vibration. Listeners, say it with me at home.
But yeah, you're talking about kind of a new agey,
right? But this
way
was
to talk about
18th
spirituality.
Century that he wrote. Well, wait, when did he write this?
He wrote this toward the end of his life. So we were in there
he was
very
in the 20th
early
century when he wrote this.
Yes,
okay.
Very early 20th century when he wrote that. But I mean, I take your point. I doubt that people at this particular time, it was very popular to be like, I reject Catholicism and I believe in the intense vibration of art. Like, I don't think that, a lot of people were saying it back then. Like, Rilke was one of the only ones, which is why he's so, he's ahead of the curve.
And it's interesting because you were talking about the musicality of the poem and the musicality in the language. And vibration has both a musical connotation and the stanza before it talks about the crystal cup. Everybody's like, Olivia, get over the crystal cup. But, that is where
we get over the crystal cup. It's so wonderful.
I can't. But that also has a connotation. The vibrations, like the way that you can hear sound through glass. So.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's an excellent point that I hadn't really considered. Your most intense vibration. It also, the crystal cup that shattered even as it rang, right? It suggests that the cup is ringing so hard.
That it breaks.
That it breaks itself.
Right.
Right. But it breaks itself with a kind of gorgeous beauty.
Like when an opera singer breaks a glass. Right. That's a triumph.
A vibration.
Exactly.
A triumph of vibration. Yes.
Yes. And to go to Max's point about vibes, in the Robert Temple translation I'm seeing here, that line is the endless ground of your own inner vibration. So again, that like that thing that's within you, mm-hmm. that it is vibes.
I am feeling some excitement about this poem, generally speaking. I was really happy when you chose it, actually, because I feel like my tendency is to choose really sad or dark work.
But I'm down with that.
Oh, I know
this
you're
is
down
still,
with that.
This is still edge.
There's still some
we
edge.
We still got to talk about decapitation.
This is This is still whistling in the graveyard kind of poetry.
It is.
I suppose.
In a Swiss graveyard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I suppose it does say be forever dead in Eurydice. So it's a little goth.
It also has the great void. You can't have a, you know, a happy poem with really the great void right there.
No, you're right. Actually, that's a really fine point, actually, with this poem. I do feel that it is ultimately joyful, for sure. And what he's doing there really is canceling the count of the good and bad in the poem. Right. Like, and so it has this really satisfying balance at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Though not discussed in detail, let's do that poem one more time.
Be Ahead of All Parting by Rainier Marie Rilke. Be ahead of all parting, as though it already were behind you, like the winter that has just gone by. For among these winters, there is one so endlessly winter that only by wintering through it all will your heart survive. Be forever dead in Eurydice, more gladly arise into the seamless life proclaimed in your song. Here, in the realm of decline, among momentary days, be the crystal cup that shattered even as it rang. Be, and yet know, the great void where all things begin, that infinite source of your own most intense vibration, so that this once you may give it your perfect assent. To all that is used up, to all the muffled and dumb creatures in the world's full reserve, the unsayable sums, joyfully add yourself and cancel the count.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us, for being willing to come down into our dank basement and record this with us.
If you happen to be in the Portland area or the greater Portland area and happen to be pregnant. You do have a website, right? That we link a website on
I do. It's ridiculously simple. I'm doulaolivia.com.
And that will be in our show notes, which you can find.
And also, I would just like to ask everybody who's listening in to sort of silently give good wishes to Olivia and David, knowing that they are going to be married in October. And just send them joy.
Some good vibes.
Good vibes.
Good vibes.
They don't need any well wishes of luck.
No, they certainly don't need any luck.
It's a good union.
But yeah, send them joy and send them good vibes.
Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you very much.
For those of you in the D.C. or Northern Virginia area, I'll be reading on Friday, October 12th. At 6 p.m. at Epicure Cafe as part of George Mason University's Fall for the Book Festival. And I look forward to seeing you there. To remind you, we have links on the homepage for you to subscribe to our show on iTunes and Spotify.
Show notes have their own tab on our site where you can find Olivia's link.
If you have a comment or suggestion or whatever, you can just shoot us a message on our contact page.
And as a reminder, if you want to hear Danielle read some of her own work, click on the Vanity Press tab on our own website.
This has been Vita Readings.
Lit from the Basement.
This is Danielle.
This is Max.
This is Olivia.
And this is David.
Wishing you a good night.
Thank you for being here. Bye-bye.
to translate. there's no way to transition into something.
Can you hand me some more wine?
You should just, anytime you want a segue, yeah, but can't think of one, you should just go segue. Yeah.
Thank Here's you. Some more wine. Don't let it whip you up into a Dionysian frenzy.
Yeah, ma'am. I am the poet here,
so please don't tear me limb from limb if things get... I don't know how you'd get into a frenzy by yourself. I think that'd be a little bit terrifying, but...
You have to be a very particular kind of person.
I mean, I've seen it. I've seen it happen.